Busy routines can make it hard to focus on your health goals, but MedExpress offers a simple way to explore weight management treatment online. Complete our short eligibility consultation with no need for face-to-face appointments or travel. If eligible, treatment is delivered discreetly, with UK-registered clinicians offering support along the way. Visit medexpress.co.uk/podcast to get started today.
Welcome back to the show. Today, we're talking about something that so many people are dealing with right now: fear, emotional overwhelm, stress, grief, and that feeling of being stuck in survival mode. A lot of people don't even realize what's happening inside of them. They just know that they feel off, they feel overwhelmed, they feel anxious or disconnected. And in this episode, we're going to break down what really is going on. What's more importantly, what actually helps. Now, today's guest is Dr. Randolph Shelfer. He was a former Marine. He's a physician, a psychotherapist, professor, and a writer whose work focuses on the relationship between fear, resilience, and human mind. He trained in neurology and psychiatry, and after graduating from Yale University and the University of Michigan, and spent decades of helping people build their field of neuropsychiatry. But some of the most meaningful insights came from a deeply personal experience when his young son was diagnosed with leukemia at just the age of 3 years old. During this time, he began telling stories at night to him to help him navigate the fear, the uncertainty, and the loss. Those experiences shape the work he does today, exploring how fear becomes more manageable when it is shaped how emotional overwhelm affects us, and how people can begin to move forward toward resilience and healing. So many people today feel like they're constantly in stress, anxiety, or survival mode. What is actually happening in the mind and the body when someone feels emotionally overwhelmed?
Thanks for having me, Stacey. It's really fun to meet you and to talk about the topics we're going to talk about. The first thing I'll say is some of this chronic stress and apprehension of our, at least here in the West, the Western civilizations, is justified. We live in an apprehensive and anxious and uncertain world. Job positions come and go on the basis of the latest artificial intelligence, structural insights and changes, affordability. People who are college educated and fairly successful, affordability of life and homes is at a great distance right now. And in the world around us, we have chronic and intermittent warfare with large blocks of other nations, the old communist countries and some of the radical Muslim countries in the Middle East. We're fighting them. And so a lot of this is justified. But since you and I cannot do anything about those matters, from artificial intelligence to communist China, what we can do and must do is see what we can do internally to make our peace with it, to live a good life, to find meaning for ourselves. Marcus Aurelius, the Roman emperor, wrote about this 2,000 years ago.
That's amazing. You talk about how fear becomes more manageable when it is experienced alongside a trusted person. Why does connection make such a powerful difference in how we process fear?
Fear is healthy. Every normal person has fear, but resilience and courage or variance of those things are required to live our lives. They don't mean the fear is not there. They mean we move along in spite of it. And that's what happened with our son now 35 years ago when he developed acute lymphocytic leukemia at age 3. Terrible ordeal that lay ahead for him. So I thought I would design these bedtime stories and tell them in serialized form to him and his younger brother, at least for the first year, to give him mythological characters, stories of courage, of overcoming fear, of heroism. And I think it worked out. At that time, see, I was always in pediatrics too, in the major medical centers. And acute lymphocytic leukemia at that time was 50% fatal. But I knew from my experiences with those children, of the 50% who died, only about half of them died because of the biology of the disease. The other half died because they couldn't take the treatment or their families couldn't take the treatment. So that was where I was aiming these stories. So our son would be toughened up to endure the treatments. And he was.
It's amazing what you could do with children's books and stories, how they can affect our children's lives and how they can better our children's lives. I remember when my children first visualized and they saw me have a seizure when they were very young, I had taken a bunch of pieces of paper and I had drawn stick figures and I showed, this is what happens when mommy has epilepsy. This is what it is. And this is how, you know, this is what you'll do. And I went through the whole thing in stick figures and made a little story out of it. Later on in life, I wrote a book about it, but that helped them overcome a lot of the fears that they experienced when they saw mom have a seizure for the first time. So I can understand when you're talking about how you wrote those stories, the massive effect that it could have in a positive way on your child.
Yes. You see, what you were doing for your child or children was you were showing them that you were not afraid of the seizures and the epilepsy. And that is very reassuring to them. Many adults believe that children are fragile and we can't talk with them about serious things, whether it's health and disease, death, whatever. Actually, they're quite accepting as long as we show them that we're not afraid of it. And that kind of identification then stays within them going forward. It's like a legacy, an example legacy of how to face difficult issues, fearful issues from us to them.
A lot of people think fear means something that is wrong with them, but you say fear is not a weakness. It's information. Now, can you explain that, you know, what it really means to people? Like we just started to go into it a little bit, but can you go more deeper into it? Because a lot of times parents have a tendency of hiding things from their children. Yes. And they hide things from other adults too, thinking that they're not going to be able to handle it, that it's weakness.
Yes. We all have fears, as Kevin Costner said in the Bodyguard movie, to the son of the movie star. Everybody is afraid of something. And if you're not, you're abnormal and dysfunctional in this world. So storytelling is a very powerful way. Modeling too, what we just talked about, because the children know who we are. If we show them we're not afraid of difficult topics, but storytelling gives controlled myths, mythical characters with the strongest positive values of our Western culture, responsibility, courage, leadership, taking care of others. And I do have a complaint about a lot of children's books at the present time. I think they're very mushy. A lot of them are soft and coddling, you know, very banal and boring, in my opinion. And I think the reason that that's happened is we're in kind of an epidemic of grown-ups now who feel that we don't want the child to be afraid. We don't want the child to have a failure experience. It might upset her. And we don't want the child to have any, you know, chronic stressors and anxiety. But it can't be avoided. The only question is how we bring them up to do it. And they self-learn. If they get good examples from us, from their relationships, from our stories, they learn themselves as they go through life what's dangerous, what's not.
I agree. I agree completely. I think you're right. I think sometimes some of these books are too mushy and that children are stronger than we realize. And that the better we explain things, the stronger they will become, the more they will understand, and the better equipped they will be to handle these things in the present tense and in the future as well.
Absolutely. And if you look at the most famous collection of children's stories in the world, the Grimm fairy tales from the twin brothers from the early 19th century, they're very violent and they have evil characters in them. Children accept the notion of evil people and evil spirits very well. They kind of already believe in it. So if we pretend, and there are such things in the world, there is a lot of evil out there in the world. So if we try to pretend that to the children that it's not true, they know we're fudging them.
Yeah, I agree. Now, I want to talk about grief and life changes. Whether it's loss or illness or burnout or major transitions, you know, these experiences can really shake someone's identity. What do people need to understand about how these moments can affect them emotionally?
Yeah, everyone has them. They're different for each person. What comes out of it, and sometimes here's where insight psychotherapy helps. I have many sayings. One of them is everyone needs psychotherapy at some time in his or her life, although not everyone gets it. But out of a terrible experience, you know, we've been talking about those, a new self is born, a new identity, new identifications, new activities, new directions, new meaningfulness. That's healthy. It's inevitable. These changes in the life cycle that I was telling you about, I think there's three blocks to it. The first 30 years are the development of our initial identity, getting an idea who we are, what our strengths are, not aiming low and what we want to do, but having a realistic idea of what's possible, who we are, et cetera. Then there's 30 years in the middle where we do our duty. We make our family such as it is in whatever form. We do our work. We contribute to our community and to our friends. Sometimes later in life, it's hard to remember those middle 30 years because it was one day after another. And then now we have a third phase that I'm in, the 30 years, more or less after 60. And that's kind of an unknown area. But I think here, that's a chance for people to invent themselves using what fulfilled them in their youth. So for me, I'm now a writer of children's books and novels and others and medical stories, because that was always in me. For the first 60 years, I didn't have time or ability to do it. Now I do it, and I really like it.
So why do some people stay stuck in survival mode even after the situation has passed? And how can someone begin to recognize that they're in that state?
Well, that's a hard question to answer. I talked just before about how people use those painful events, life-disturbing events, identity-threatening events, which we all have, to grow, to become a new person, to move on. But many people get stuck. There are various, Freud called these developmental arrests in development. The life cycle and emotional development is constant from the beginning to the end, but some people get stuck at certain ages. He thought that it was just something that the brain, he was a neurologist, a prominent neurologist before he was a psychiatrist. I think he just thought that the brain would just do that unless it was prompted, helped, stimulated. And that's why I mentioned the importance of psychotherapies at times like that to maybe help move the needle from where it is stuck. Because if you don't move, and many people don't, many people stay stuck. And then you have what in the last 30 years, chronic dissatisfaction, necessarily at a big level, and regrets that you didn't move. What I found presiding over hundreds and hundreds of deaths in the big hospitals, people have those regrets in their third stage of their life. They cannot die easily. They cannot let go.
Yeah, I've noticed that too. When people hold regrets, it is hard for them to pass and to let go. You know, when you let go and you learn how to accept and you're able to move that needle and you don't have those regrets over your shoulder anymore. A lot of people, you know, are able to go through life at that point and be able to have a smoother, more productive life. And then when the time comes, when it's their time to cross over to the heavens, they're able to do it in a more positive, more reinforcing, smoother way than someone who has those regrets holding over their shoulders.
Yes. And the primal fear of all fears in our present society is the fear of death, the inability to talk about it with family or friends. I can't tell you how many people I took care of who died and really had never discussed it with their spouse, their children. You know, we worship youth and eternal life. If you turn on the television, which I don't do unless there's a sports event I want to watch, if there are advertisements to make you look young, be young, take these pills and you'll be able to tiptoe up and down the stair. Wait a minute, what is this, like 1870 and the traveling medicine guys are coming through in their wagons again? But underlying it all is the inability of accepting that it comes to an end. And if you're not able to do that, then you can't let go. And I also think it compromises getting back to how one moves on through the crises of life. If you feel that time is forever, there's no hurry to. But if through every day of your life you feel the ending, that there will be an ending, then I think you make better decisions.
I agree 100%. You know, I think people, they think, well, you know, life, you know, I'll just do it later. But if you really think about it, and you don't know how much later you really have. Anything could happen. You have to really, you know, I always believe you have to live in the moment. You know, you really have to don't take life for granted, because we don't know what's going to happen. We assume, you know, the future, but realistically, we don't know what's going to happen. So we should look at today in the present moment and do what and try to move forward and do the things that we really want to do and want to accomplish, and the knowledge that we've attained what are other things that we want to do that will make us more happy and more fulfilling in life? Because at the moment, we have the ability to do it. But who knows in the future if we'll still have that ability?
Yes, I lived most of my life each day feeling, what if this were the last day? What would I do? I tried to explain this to my wonderful wife when we were going to get married 45 years ago. She thought I was suicidal. She didn't want to hear it. So I didn't tell her anymore. But if you do that, then you end up making better decisions.
I agree 100%. Now, you've talked about storytelling as a way to process fear and uncertainty. How does storytelling actually help people work through the difficult emotions?
The storytelling is for small children, young children. Although we all love stories. If you look at those serial things on Netflix, which I don't do, but if you look at them, they're just storytelling for grownups. So we like the storytellings or something just inside of us. It just feels good. It conveys a message to us, which is helpful. It's entertaining, whatever. But the kind of key stories for children that I'm talking about and writing, hopefully in the children's book that I've written, those stories stay with them inside as models of how to live their lives and what to do. I could tell one story about this. I don't want to go into too much of this about war stories, but one time I had an encounter in Vietnam with the NVA, the North Vietnamese Army, and I could have and maybe should have just shot down these, but I had an image from my own past, a story from my time at Yale. There was a heroic, mythical figure in the Yale literature called Frank Merriwell. I read some of these stories when I was at Yale. This is at a late, but still like late teenage years. Frank was just the world's most heroic guy, great male, handsome, tall, a superb athlete, always honest, generous, kind. And I stood over those enemy soldiers that day, and all of a sudden, Frank Merriwell's image intruded into my mind because they weren't resisting. They weren't going to run or they weren't going to shoot back. So I thought, well, what would Frank Merriwell do here? So I let him go. And then for a day, I felt so good about myself that I had done, you know, what that image from the past when I was young, when I was a teenager. But here, except turned out to be very wrong because those enemy troops were on their way to do something, which they did 2-3 days later, and I had let them go and it was bad. So I think what that shows is the power of those mythical figures from the past, but also maybe you can't trust them all.
Yeah. I always say sometimes too, we have to trust our gut and our heart because, you know, and I think 10% of our brain is logic. And then we, you know, we go by our subconscious, like we were talking about before we started the podcast, and our gut feeling and our heart, you know, what is that saying to us? I always believe that our heart really talks to our brain, and then we have our gut. And then, you know, but it's the heart, in my opinion, this is only my opinion, but the heart is, sends messages to the brain and the brain reacts and tells the body what to do. But, you know, I always feel that it's our heart who leads us and it's our gut that leads us. And you know, it seems like in that case, your gut and your heart were leading you.
Yeah, I agree with you. That's true. The gut and the heart make much better decisions than the brain, but you have to train them. So, for example, in medicine, young doctors can be smart, but they can't be good. It takes experience being wrong. And when I first started out, I would very obsessively, like for diagnostics, especially in neurology, think about all the lab tests, all the imaging, get all these tests, think it all over, write out the nervous, you know. But then toward the end, I would not do any of that. I just look at them, talk, listen to them a little bit, and tell them, you got this, and this is what we're going to do. And I had seen that before in some of my mentors, very famous men in American neurology, but they were old. That's how they did it. They wouldn't do a lot of tests. They just look at the person. They had the experience and they had trained their unconscious. This was their life. And it was mine after 35 years too, just to interact with these people briefly and then tell them what was wrong and move on. And that was much more accurate and getting a lot of tests.
I love that. I love that. Now, for parents, partners, or caregivers listening, how can they become, you know, that trusted presence that helps someone else feel safer?
They have to buy my children's book and read it because I don't think it really is a children's book. Well, maybe it is, but I think it's really a book for parents because the the storyteller, the father figure, has a fatal disease. He only has a year to live. So the stories are his legacy in a period of limited time for his children. But we all have limited time with the children. The book is really, it takes up the more difficult question of, if we only have limited time to transmit our legacies to our young children, what story should we tell them? That's what the book is about.
I like that. I think storytelling is so powerful. I think it's powerful for both adults and children. I think the reason why adults love stories is because we're just children in a grown-up body. Hopefully most of us become much more mature. I can't say for all, but if you go back and you think about the same foods you liked, a lot of the ways that you act, if you were a jokester when you were a kid, most likely you'll be a jokester when you're adult. We are children in adult bodies.
Right. That's another thing I'm doing now that I'm in the third stage of the life cycle. I'm letting myself become childlike again. Have to be careful there. Can't let it get out of control, but just being more playful, being more authentic about what I feel, saying things that I don't have to inhibit anymore, and not spending time with people whom I find boring.
Right. Exactly. Now, what are some of the signs that someone might be emotionally overwhelmed, but not yet realize it?
That is probably these chronic stress syndromes, which we call burnout. I think that's actually a very useful word because we all know what it means, although it's hard to say. But what happens after a prolonged period of meaningless stress, usually at work, people get irritable. They lose their sense of humor. They lose their empathic ability to relate in a generative and kind way with others. They have sleep disturbance. And whether or not there's neurobiological effects, chronic immunologic deficiency with these syndromes, I believe that's not settled yet. I was thinking about that and looking into the science of that before I quit medicine. And there is some science to suggest that it might have an immunodeficiency effect too, but it's not clear that that's true.
Right. Now, I want to just take a couple of steps back because I really admire your book and I really love the storytelling in the book and I love the reasons why you wrote the book. Can you talk a little bit about your book and tell everybody what it's called? And also, can you tell what the story about? And we mentioned it a little bit earlier, but really go a little bit more in detail about what motivated you to really write this story and, how when you wrote this story, because when we write stories like that, when we go into nonfiction or we go into storytelling about a difficult issue in our life or we're trying to help people, but it's motivated by something that happened in our life, it also makes a transition in our own lives when we're writing it, whether it's storytelling or it's an adult book, of an adult book, but tell the title of the book, what motivated the book, and how it's made a huge transition in your life, not just the people that have been reading it.
The book is called Bedtime Stories That Will Terrify Children and Keep Them Awake All Night Long. I just love the provocative quality of it. And a number of people out there do. And they think, wow, this guy's really an original thinker in children's literature. I know nothing about children. And then there's a whole group of people who think, that is so offensive. That will destroy our children and make them all zombies, whatever. I enjoy that conflict and I'm watching it play out. The 8 stories, each has the name of an animal to it, like dog, squirrel, etc. The first one is simplistic, to do with a strange noise in the night for the 2 young boys when they hear it and how to handle it. But it's only the dog who's been locked out. But the stories escalate. They become much more complex. They're not necessarily about fear. Heroism comes into it. Self-sacrifice, fictional characters who are damaged in birth, but crippled, for example, who become heroic. The later stories are much more complex, like the squirrel story is about an evil squirrel who presides over the ragged hole in space and time, which eats children. That actually was our boy's favorite story. But then in the end, by the 8th story, the father's time is over for the year, and his death comes into it in a metaphorical way based on his own personal experience. Well, I had this in mind when I told those stories. I didn't write them till recently. I told them 35 years ago, but then I had a plan for it. Actually, I didn't it just seemed like the right thing to do. I just started telling them, the stories came, and they did last about a year. The boys loved them. They just, each day, I think they would hang on to the moment after the bathtub when they could hear the story. So they really liked them, and they evolved in a very kind of wild and otherworldly way. But looking back on it, I think I was preparing them for both of them for should the worst happen.
I think that's wonderful. I like how you did that. When did you create those stories from your own experiences in life, or did they just come to you?
Just made them up. And I don't want to get too personal, but we didn't have bedtime stories when I was young, but I made the characters outrageous. Igor, the hunchback in the school, who's actually very heroic. So characters like that, I would make the description of them quite graphic, and you couldn't make it. Those descriptions sounded frightening for the children, or they couldn't be reassuring when they found out how kind-hearted Igor was. And of course, that story, we're talking about prejudice against people less fortunate or different from we. And so I was picking up those themes, but I made them all up as I went. I've always had a busy brain.
I love that. My son loves stories like that. And I have to say, he has a very strong personality. And I mean that in a good way. He's a strong individual with a lot of resilience, but he also liked stories like that. He was drawn to stories like that. And I do think they help in a children's mind. They prepare them in some way, form, or fashion about today's world and what to expect. I see a lot of times in today's life, people try to protect their children and make their children feel like they're in a beautiful home and a white picket fence. But that's not what real life is. And when you get out into real life, and if you're not prepared to know what might be, that there's bad out there, that there's difficulties out there, that you need to be resilient in certain situations, then you realize, from those childlike stories that life isn't perfect. So when those things happen to you in life, you're expecting it, and you have some idea of ways that you can actually cope with it too.
There's tremendous suspense in these stories about whether the outcome will be good or bad. It doesn't seem, and in most of them, it seems likely that it will be bad, although the intervention is by some of the characters prevented from being. And the children love that suspense, and they know things don't necessarily work out. And they learn that at a very early age, so they love the recreation of that suspense in the story. And that's why I think kind of simplistic children's books about whatever, a choo-choo train who is so anxious about his run the next day that he won't be able to get up a small hill, I'm not so sure that's doing anything.
I always enjoyed stuff like that when I was a kid too.
Now, it may be that girl children are different from boy children. All we had was two boy children. So I don't know that for. So one possibility is that these stories, which come from my unconscious and preconscious, they're very action-oriented, good versus evil, cowardice versus courage.
I always liked a lot of that type of stuff. I think it's just the personality. You're always going to find different personalities. But for me personally, I was always drawn to that type of stuff. I always liked stuff like that. I think it just matters on the child's personality. But before we go, where can people actually find these books?
I have a website, which Angela McKenna of O'Mara Press, my great publisher, has made. If you go to my website, if you put my name, randolphschiffer.com, the website comes up. It's like going through the looking glass into a whole new universe, and the books are there. You can buy them or whatever. Some bookstores have them, but that's the most reliable way, going to the website.
I love it. Now, if someone was listening right now and they're going through fear, grief, or a difficult time in life's transition, what is one message that you would want them to remember about resilience?
Odyssey says, Odysseus said on the raft when it looked like he would never get home, he said, "Endure, my heart, far worse hast thou endured."
I love that. Before we go, is there a couple of takeaways that you'd like people to remember from this episode that we discussed?
Well, that would be more for you to say. What do you think would be the key takeaway from this?
Well, I think this has been an important and a powerful conversation. We talked about fear, we talked about stress, we talked about emotional overwhelm, and how so many people are dealing with and and understanding how to move through it, because so many people get stuck when things don't go exactly how they want it to go and how they planned, and they just don't know how to move the needle and get to the next. You know, people don't know sometimes how to overcome the crisis and overcome the obstacles that they face, and then be able to move forward so they can make their dreams become a reality. And it's not an easy thing to do, but it's very possible. Understanding what's happening and how to move through it can actually truly make a difference. And I think that you today, by answering the questions that, you know, I asked you, you know, you have so much knowledge in so many of those areas, I think you're able to really shed light that anything is really possible. People can overcome crisis. You know, we go through grief in life, we go through anger, we go through different types of stresses in life. We have things that happen and we become overwhelmed. And it's really just learning how to deal and how to cope with these situations and not get stuck, and just be able to move forward in life. And, you know, and preparing people when they just get older, but trying to prepare them when they're younger. And your children book actually does that by showing them that life isn't perfect. You know, life has obstacles, and they're going to get obstacles from the way beginning, from school. You know, they might not have as difficult when they become as an adult, but they're going to have their adult, you know, they're going to have obstacles in their childhood lives. And to them, it's going to be major. High school, it's same thing. And as we get older, you know, we're going to get, you know, obstacles. So show today that there is a way. Where there's a will, there's a way. We just have to learn the techniques and the coping skills to move forward. And when you retired, you went back and you wrote a children's book, really showing people the same, but in a childlike way, preparing children. So I think today was great, because whether you realize it or not, your children book really prepares children for the real world. And the questions that we talked about are real life situations as adults, you know, but it's so important that parents today, especially in the Gen Z area, where I feel a lot of people are trying to protect their children so much that their children aren't ready for the real world, because when they get there, they're overwhelmed very easily. Because if we try to protect our children, and we should protect our children, but sometimes it's good to be right behind them and let them fall and try to let them get themselves up. And once they get them, if they can't get themselves up, we're right here to help them get up. But giving them the ability to get up on their own makes them stronger, makes them prepared, and makes them understand the obstacle and how. And so when the next things occur, they become stronger and stronger as time goes on.
It's probably time now. That quality you're talking about, part of resilience, which is not getting stuck, that's extremely important, because that raises the issue of suicide, which has become epidemic in our society. We don't have time to get into this today. It's interesting that I didn't mention that, but suicide haunts the getting stuck quality, and it's a serious problem. But we'll have to talk about that another. I think we better.
I'd love to have you back on the show so we can talk about that, because that is an issue that is on the rise, and it is a very serious issue. I think today was a wonderful show. I think you're a wonderful individual. You've been through so much in life. You've accomplished so much in life. And you're giving back, you know, by now helping children and see the world in a different light. So I thank you so much for being on the show. I thank you for all your accomplishments and the things that you've done in life to help others. And I appreciate you. And I thank you so much for being here.
Well, those words are so kind. I'd like to come back on the show just to hear them again. Thank you, Stacey.
You're so welcome. You have a great day.
Bye-bye.